Good afternoon and welcome to the a.s.r. conference call on its annual results 2014. The call will be hosted by Chris Figee, CFO of a.s.r., and Jack Julliger, CIO Financial Markets. At this moment, all participants are in listen-only mode. After the presentation, there will be opportunity to ask questions. I would like to hand over the conference to Chris Figee and Jack Julliger. Go ahead, sir.
Very good. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Welcome to the annual results presentation of a.s.r. I'm joined here by Jack Julliger, CIO of Financial Markets, and Jack and I will walk you through the 2014 results of a.s.r. And as is customary, keep time available for questions and answers afterwards. Before we start, a small personal color to this presentation. You may be aware this actually is a skiing holiday week in the Netherlands. And a few months ago, I told my girlfriend, "Look, darling, we cannot go skiing this year because I have to present the a.s.r. numbers." And she looked at me and she said, "Is that so? So we can't go skiing because you present the numbers? Well, then these better be damn good numbers." So it is with professional pride and some personal relief that I'm taking you to page number three, presenting you the result of a.s.r. at 381 million, up 100 million euros from last year. If there are four things I'd like you to remember, it is one, net profit up 100 million last year. Second, the increase in results really driven by an improved underwriting results and lower cost. Together, they determine or drive about two-thirds of the result improvement, with the remainder coming from higher investment returns and a number of incidental results. So the bulk of the result increase really is sustainable and lasting. Third point, very robust solvency, S1 at 285%, up significantly from last year. Solvency II, we estimate at this point in time at 175%, with a UFR impact of 81% on S1. So Solvency I ex UFR still safely above the 200% mark. And the fourth thing for you to remember, with these numbers, we believe a.s.r. is ready to return to private hands in whatever shape or form that may come, but the group is ready to be owned by private shareholders again. Those are the key things to remember, and we'll go through them in the course of the presentation. If you'd like to follow me to page number four, where we say a few words about our position in society and about customers, because after all, and in the end, everything starts with the customer. Our business is about really satisfying real and live and present customer needs, deliver innovative, successful, and attractive service and products, and we are very much aware of our role and importance in society. Page four highlights a series of points. Couple of remarks I'd like to pick up. Ever since we started to measure the Net Promoter Score, the NPS, in 2014, we achieved the highest NPS score in our history as a testimony to our increasing recognition by customers of our successful products and services. On the product side, we launched a number of new products, for example, a disability insurance for the individual entrepreneurs, ZZP'ers in Dutch. Good progress in sales and recognition by our SME, defined contribution product, the werknemerspensioen, and a number of product awards, both in the banking side, but also on liability insurance. And finally, on the investment side, the Fair Insurance Guide and the Association of Sustainable Investors keep on ranking a.s.r. amongst the top three of responsible and sustainable insurance and investment companies. So overall, we're very glad that together with good and solid financial results, we keep on delivering value to our customers. Page five again has the key numbers of the group. Net result up from 281 to 381. Premium levels roughly stable. A small decline. The P&C or non-life business stable, a decline in life, which is in line with market developments. Operational costs down from 547 to 541. And even if you look through these results and you go to the cost associated with the regular business, actually down significantly more, from 535 to 499. Solvency level 268 to 285. And with this strong solvency comes an ROE of 12.4%, which is, in my mind, very attractive, very effective. One caveat, the ROE is somewhat flattered by the 500 million IAS 19 deduction from our equity, an accounting treatment of our own pension fund. If you deduct or adjust for that 500 million downtick, the ROE moves from 9.9 to 10.7, which is probably a more fairer perspective on our return, but still a 10.7 ROE is something I feel very comfortable with. So those would be the key figures, and again, reiterating the key messages, result up, driven by sustainable and lasting improvements, solvency high and solvent and solid, and ASR ready to return to the private sector. In order to get a better view on what's behind that result increase, we, for the first time, published an underlying result analysis. As I said, about two-thirds of the result increase is driven by an increase in underwriting result and an increase in or decrease in costs. This page gives a more scientific, almost structured approach towards result analysis. Of course, any underlying result or normalization bears a degree of judgment with it. But the ultimate result of this analysis I feel very comfortable with. What we've done on this page is first normalize the investment results. We take out any capital gains and replace them by long-term investment returns. And then we normalize for regular business activities, operating items, non-operating items, and some restructuring expenses. Amongst which, for example, the VOBA impairment we took in 2014 or the VGA-ER provision we took last year. In our appendix, you find more details on this normalization and adjustment result analysis. But overall, at the end of that analysis, it results in an increase 345 to 419, which is a 74 million profit increase or an increase of 20%. So whether you look at our results from an IFRS perspective or from an adjusted normalized perspective, the result is still a significant increase in our profit and testimony to the resilience and structural nature of the result improvement of our group. Then on the cost side, page number 7. As you can see on this page, our costs continue to decline. Ever since 2011, our cost base declined by 13%. Actually, our staff base since 2009 declined by 23%. So we're a group that strives to and achieves a continuous and gradual decrease in costs year on year on year. If you look at the operational cost of the business, they decline from 535 to 499. And by these operational expenses that are really associated with regular business activities, we exclude, for example, exit costs or strategic projects. We exclude new startups, new business initiatives. And we exclude an accounting phenomenon where we change the treatment of some of the pension charges that moves from interest expense to operating costs. If you take those out and you look at the cost rates of the ordinary business of the insurance activities, they decline by 7%, 535 to 499, which is then in line with the reduction of internal staff of 7% over the last year. The cost premium ratio of the insurance business, which of course is an amalgamation of different business lines, but still, the cost to premium ratio declines below 10% in 2014. And we feel comfortable that the cost achievement that we've delivered over the past years will continue into the next year. We've already announced this year that we'll part with some of our employees on the life business in order to reflect the shrinking life volumes. So you see that our cost performance in the coming years will be continuing the trend that we've put in ever since 2011. Then going to the different lines of business. Starting with the non-life segment on page number 8, you can all see a marked increase in results from 5 million last year to 148 this year. Partly because last year we made a significant additional provisioning for Via VGA. There was no need, certainly no need, to repeat that provision again. I can safely say the current provision level of Aegea, which is slightly north of 500 million, is absolutely adequate, and any prudency levels that we've included in that provision have not yet been affected, are still there. We feel very comfortable with the current level of provisioning via Aegea. What is important to me in the non-life business is that the combined ratio of all our product lines is now below 100%. That is a combined ratio that includes all businesses, so no discontinued operations or run-off operations. It really is a combined of all P&C activities, including everything. Combined ratio of the group is now 94.9%. If you go to the different product lines, you can see that each and every product line is actually below 100%. Also, if you double-click one level deeper, if it would be motor or fire or liability, it's all below 100%. That's something we feel very comfortable and with and proud of. On the P&C side, just to deep dive a bit on that segment, our group has historically pursued a value over volume strategy. The claims ratio of the group underneath the combined is below 60%. That is structurally at below 60% and comfortably below 60%. If you look back at 2014, the first half year was characterized by very benign weather, hardly any large claims. The first year with claims ratio in the low 50s. Second half of the year was in the mid to high 50s, as we had some rainstorms in the summer and some increase in the inevitable larger claims. Overall, claims ratio across the year was below 60%. Generally speaking, the claims frequency is starting to drift lower, which is a sign and a reflection of solid and healthy underwriting. Going forward, the group tends to aim a combined of 95%-98%, and I feel comfortable continuing to operate in the better half of that range, the lower half of that range. On the disability side, combined moved from 118% to 91.4%. If you strip out via Aegea, we're about stable at around the 91% mark. Again, with prudent reserving, there were no reserve releases. We did not rely on reserve releases. Prudent reserving and stable reserving on the disability side as well. Volume-wise, a small increase in disability in AOV, and a small decline in P&C. We're seeing in P&C the value over volume strategy paying off. It does cost some volume, but the shrinkage of the book is actually becoming less and less. The decline of the book is half versus last year. If I look at the sales figures in the second half and the fourth quarter of 2014, they tend to bode well for whatever is coming in 2014. Our non-life segment is really shining with a structural and stable combined, and increasingly underpinned and supported volumes. Page nine takes us to the life business. You can see a net result from 367 down a bit towards 2014. Couple of remarks. We impaired part of the VOBA. VOBA stands for Value of Business Acquired, which is a type of goodwill measure, a type of goodwill metric, that was created with the merger of Stad Rotterdam and AMF about 14 years ago. Every year we test the VOBA. We test the sustainability of this VOBA asset on our balance sheet. This year we moved to a more granular testing, not for the portfolio as a whole, but line by line, sub-portfolio by sub-portfolio. We felt it was only reasonable to impair part of the VOBA that was connected to unit-linked policies. We decided that a 70 million post-tax impairment of a part of the VOBA, that part linked to part of the unit-linked policies, was actually fair and reasonable to do. Suffice to say that the liability adequacy tests, whether it's WFD, i.e. a D&B test, or it's IFRS, is all sufficiently significantly positive, and you talk about three-digit surpluses at least, for both D&B LAT test or the IFRS LAT test. Our strategy in life is to maintain volumes and reduce cost. You can see the life book is shrinking, which is inevitable. Policies are expiring. The market is not growing. Our policy and what we're striving for is to maintain volumes. reduce unnatural lapses. Unnatural lapses are hovering about 1.5-1.6% for the last 5 quarters, which is sustainable and I think is actually acceptable to us. And we're working on increasing more cost variability, that is, the cost per policy should be stable or should be going down. And over the past years and in 2014, again, achieved a stable to declining cost per policy. So we've been able to follow the reducing volume with reduction in costs. Second important segment in the life business is pensions, where we are increasingly active in the market again. Our pensions group has a clear focus, a clear mandate. One, reduce cost. Take out costs by about 40%. In the net cost program, we're about halfway and on track. You may have seen we decided to outsource part of our back office activities to Infosys, moving it to India, so the pensions team is not shying away from making difficult, hard decisions in order to reduce our cost base. Second objective, increase the new business into the DC and PPI segment. We've launched the successful DC product, where about 700 employers have signed up. And we now are the number 3 PPI in the Netherlands with almost 1,000 employer customers. So we're seeing quite some good growth, good figures on the DC slash PPI side. Third objective, maintain volume in the rest of the book and minimize sacrifice of value, i.e. retain the book at about 65% and retain volumes at about 80%. And I think that we've again achieved. Retention ratios were significantly above 65% if we include the PPI. So the pension book is delivering on taking out costs, on moving new business to DC and PPI, and being very vigilant and holding back on guaranteed businesses or DB solutions. And finally, in the life segment, we have a funeral business where we are market leader, at least by number of customers, number of policies. I think we're running 4 million policies by about 80 individuals in Enschede. It's a small jewel in the crown of ASR, our funeral book. They continue to write new business and continue to write very profitable new business. The nice thing about our life and pensions business is because of our life and funeral book, the group is by and large hedged against mortality risk. So our mortality and longevity exposure are more or less in balance. So the new mortality table that was introduced this year didn't have any meaningful impact on us because it hit us and supported us on the mortality and longevity side. So the group is balanced in terms of longevity and mortality. Moving on to the segment other. As you may be aware, the segment other is basically all non-insurance business. The segment other contains the bank, contains our real estate development business, contains real estate asset management business, but also contains the holding costs. And the net result in the other segment improved markedly, basically for a few reasons. One, the losses in the real estate development business declined a lot. Last year we took some hits, so took some impairments on the development business. This year we didn't have to do that. It's a key theme for a group to de-risk ourselves from the real estate development business. And I look at it through two measures. Either it's a working total worst case exposure, or it is basically guarantees and work in progress. By both metrics, worst case exposure or guarantees plus work in progress, the group exposure declined by about 20% this year, according to plan, so gradually reducing exposure to real estate development. And no new losses in this field. On the cost side, we see some increase in costs in the other segment. Those were the costs that I referred to when we talked about costs in the cost page. We made some additional investment into new startups. We made some additional investment into exit and strategic projects. And there was a recharge of our pension costs. And that's why the cost level in the segment other increased, because they were booked in that very segment. And finally, we changed our pension scheme. We took out the unconditional inflation compensation to the retired population. We did that through the funding of a specific depot, a fund, that we put in at holding. It's a fund of 285 million that we funded through a revolving credit facility. The benefit of that fund is that by now we have no unlimited inflation compensation exposure anymore. All the inflation exposure in the pension business, in our own pension business, now bought off. It had a few nice benefits. One is Solvency II went up by 6%. Our S&P capital went up by about 5%, and we had a release in a defined benefit obligation of about net compared to last year, 50+ million. You see the segment other also affected by an accounting gain of slightly over 50 million versus last year, according to a pension free fall. In our results across P&C, across non-life, life and other, there is a lasting sustainable improvement in underwriting results, a lasting sustainable and continuous improvement in cost levels, and there is a one-off loss from the VOBA depreciation and a one-off gain from the DBO release according to the new pension rules or pension arrangements. Those incidentals roughly even out to have very little net effect on the group results. With that, we feel very comfortable with the structural results of ASR. That brings me to the development of total equity, which you can see on page 11. We believe we have a very robust and stable capital position. IFRS equity is stable at about 3.8 billion, despite, as you can see in the middle of the waterfall, the 500 million negative impact from IAS 19. As we said, the ROE moves from 10.6% to 12.4%. If we adjust for IAS 19, we took out that kind of windfall gain, windfall support to our ROE. Our ROE would move from 9.9% to 10.7%, which is something that we still be very comfortable with. Second thing to remark on this page is the hybrid capital, the hybrid issuance. In September this year, we issued a hybrid capital instrument and tendered for an existing instrument to modernize our capital structure. We were very pleased with the outcome because it did achieve a couple of objectives. Of course, full placement. Second, a placement predominantly with domestic investors. We wanted to build a domestic investor base. About 40%-45% of the book went to the Dutch investor base. A successful tender of existing instruments. Finally, good performance in the secondary market and all that we've achieved, and we've seen that. That gives me a lot of confidence that ASR is able to tap the capital market to strengthen its capital base if and when it would need so. At this point, with 3.8 billion equity, there's no immediate need to further raise capital. We feel very comfortable with this level of equity. When it comes to solvency, we move to page number 12. Again, you can see DNB solvency at 285, up from 268 last year. The delta in that solvency was affected by a couple of points. Of course, there's always the underlying result, the underlying capital generation. There was the positive contribution from the net hybrid issuance. We took out some solvency from mortgage revaluation, around 15% Solvency I. The pension arrangements that I talked about took out 13% out of our Solvency I level. Net-net, solvency went up to 285. Some of you will ask me, so I will prelude that question, what is the underlying capital generation of the group? Our IGD capital generation is about 1.5%-2% per month in this year. Because of positive market developments in the last year, we added about 0.5%-0.7% from capital markets developments as well. Overall, we achieved well over 2% per month in capital generation. That's something I feel very comfortable with and proud of. On Solvency II, for the first time, we published a Solvency II estimate, which is 175%, which is a midpoint estimate in a range. That of course comes with a large disclaimer. There is still modeling uncertainty. There are still parameter uncertainty, but our best estimate today is 175%, which is the standard model. It is the standard model, which is 175. Our ECAP ratio, which is the closest thing to an internal model, is about 190%. Please note that we do not intend to apply for internal model approval. We'll go for a standard model, for simplicity and cost and practical purposes. Overall, we believe this solvency level is very strong, and note that excluding the UFR, 81% UFR, our Solvency I is still above 200. As a matter of fact, I think ASR ex UFR is still higher than some of our peers, including UFR. That gives me, I can sleep well at night, let's put it that way. Page 13 shows the solvency develop over a longer period of time. We borrowed this page from an HSBC report where they plotted a series of European insurance on this scale, on this graph, and we wanted to see where we stood, and you can see the development of solvency over time and the gradual increase to the top right corner, which is again a reflection of the underlying month by month, year-on-year underlying capital generation of the group. Something we feel very comfortable with. We're moving into the range that is roughly our target range. Over time, you'll see this page continuing in our presentations, but S1 replaced by S2 of the on the vertical axis. Before I hand over to Jacques, from my perspective, a market increase in results, lasting and sustainable, whether I look at it from an IFRS perspective, an underlying result perspective, and that linked to a robust and solid level of solvency, whether it's S1, S2, or ECAP, is something that we feel very comfortable and proud presenting to you. With that, I'll give the floor to Jacques. Jacques Rudiger, our CIO and Head of Financial Markets.
Thanks, Chris. When we turn to page number 14, an overview is given of our investment portfolio. Our economic surrounding in 2014 was characterized by low growth and low inflation, with an imminent fear for deflation. Interest rates dropped to the lowest levels ever, and yield curves flattened. Decreases in interest rates led to an increase of the market value, especially of the fixed income portfolio. In relative terms, the composition of the investment portfolio did not change. The risk level of the portfolio was kept constant against an improved capital base, and that created room for a gradual and cautious shift to higher yielding but less liquid assets like residential mortgages. In our strategic asset allocation approach, we implemented the latest regulation as published in the Solvency II Delegated Acts. In the Q4 figures, we applied the volatility adjuster instead of the countercyclical premium. In 2014, we saw a performance of the investment portfolio that supported the strong financial performance of the company. There were three reasons for that performance. In the first place, the decision to hedge the interest rate risk on the balance sheet based on the economic curve instead of the UFR curve proved to be very successful. Secondly, we further improved the quality of our credit portfolio, especially the financials portfolio. In the third place, we focused on preventing the running yield from dropping too rapidly by increasing our investments in residential mortgages. In summary, I'm very proud that the quality and resilience of the asset base were further optimized and that the balance between market risk and our capital base improved, and that the performance was fully in line with the strong financial performance of the company. When we turn to the next page 16, we show the equities and the real estate portfolios. All fixed income categories showed a strong performance due to further drop in interest rates and tightening of spreads. Portfolio values surged, and our interest rate hedging proved to be successful, as I explained. Within the sovereigns portfolio of government portfolio, the country allocation has shifted from core countries in the Eurozone to what we call soft core and the periphery. We did that to take advantage of the illiquidity premiums. But German and Dutch bonds are still the core of our fixed income portfolio. In addition, the credit portfolio has been further diversified. In relative terms, the financials showed the best performance. We continued our policy of improving and optimizing the credit quality of our portfolio, and we did that by a barbell strategy. And then I'm talking specifically about the financials portfolio. And that barbell strategy meant that we divested Tier 1 and senior holdings and reinvested the proceeds in higher yielding, lower two, and covered bonds. We also increased our investments in corporate bonds and did first steps with respect to investments in hybrid corporate bonds. The strong performance of credits was underpinned by reversals of impairments of financials and redemptions of structured investments like CDOs, redemptions above the impaired cost price. Our interest rate hedging is based on immunizing interest rate sensitivity for changes in the economic curve instead of the UFR curve. That policy proved to be very successful in an environment of dropping rates. The market value of the derivatives portfolio went up substantially. We continued to further optimize the interest rate hedge, among others, by shifting from 15-year swaps to 30-year swaps to improve the hedge for non-parallel shifts of the yield curve. Moreover, we invested in payer swaptions for protection against rate rises. Our processes comply with the newly introduced EMIR rules, and we are ready for central clearing. Exposure to residential mortgages has been further increased, almost entirely attributable to low-risk NHG-guaranteed mortgage loans. The risk-return profile is, from a viewpoint of Solvency II, attractive. Residential mortgages protect the running yield of the portfolio from eroding too rapidly. For Solvency I and Solvency II, we use the so-called top-down method for valuation of our mortgages. And that method is based on primary market information for mortgage pricing. And in our feeling, this is a conservative approach. We can conclude that the fixed income portfolio showed a strong performance and the quality of the fixed income portfolio has improved, and that the controlled movement to less liquid, higher yielding assets, such as residential mortgages, contributes to the running yield. Let's move to page number 16. With the equity portfolio and the real estate portfolio. The relative share of equities and real estate remains stable at 15% of the total portfolio. There was, within the equity portfolio, a further diversification. We did investments in UK and Swiss corporates at a cost of European large caps and 5% participations. And our policy of hedging downward risk on the less liquid part of the portfolio, and then we are talking about the 5% participation, the equity investments in separate accounts, the downward hedges have been continued, and we used a put option strategy. The real estate portfolio is well diversified and proved to be resilient. The market for residential properties showed first signs of recovery, where retail is impacted by changes in the business model as a consequence of the internet distribution. Our retail properties are concentrated in the Dutch Prime Retail Fund for institutional investors and the a.s.r. Property Fund for policyholders, and focus is on high street and prime located properties. We saw new high profile investors in the Dutch Prime Retail Fund. The fifth placement of 250 million participations was completed in January this year, and that will lead to a further decrease in a.s.r. real estate investments of 125 million. a.s.r. is now holding a minority share of 45% in the Dutch Prime Retail Fund. The value of the real estate portfolio went up slightly as a consequence of investments in the residential properties, in rural properties, and also we proceeded with the refurbishment of our central office building for own use in Utrecht. And we are very proud that we are the owner of such a cost-efficient building, complying with the highest environmental standards. Exposure to commercial offices dropped further, partly because of negative revaluations. Impairments are limited, and the balance of impairments and revaluations overall was slightly positive, which indicates the positive impact of diversification and the high quality of our portfolio. The outcome of our strategic asset allocation study is that a well-diversified real estate portfolio under various economic scenarios contributes to the improvement of the risk-return profile of an investment portfolio. And it is for that reason that we decided not to reduce the real estate exposure further. With the last placement of participations in the Dutch Prime Retail Fund, the real estate exposure is in the target range we aim for. The weighted average vacancy rates of the total portfolio showed quite a limited increase, which also is an indication for the strong quality and diversification of our portfolio. The higher vacancy rates of offices is the result of our centralizing housing policy. Offices' own use are reallocated for commercial use due to our policy of centralizing houses. The conclusion is that the diversification of the equity portfolio was increased, that the real estate portfolio showed a good performance in the current markets and proved to be of high quality. So in summary, the main conclusions are: the performance of the investment portfolio was fully in line with the strong company performance. The quality and resilience of the asset portfolio of our balance sheet has been further optimized, and we successfully focused on preventing the running yield from declining too rapidly. And thirdly, the risk level of the investment portfolio was kept constant with an improvement of the capital base. That concludes my presentation. Chris, I hand over to you.
Jacques, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm ending the formal side of this presentation, moving to page 17, the a.s.r. financial ratios. To continue my personal story, when I showed this chart to my girlfriend yesterday evening, she said, Chris, I have no clue about insurance accounting, but they do look like damn good numbers to me. Net result, whether it's IFRS or underlying earnings up, solvency from 268 to 285 or at 175 solvency 2. Interest cover up from 7.5 to 9.9 times, even after taking on additional hybrid loan on our book. Leverage side up a bit, whether it's financial leverage or double leverage, closer to our target range. And one caveat, if you take out the 500 million IAS 19 impact, which does affect these numbers, financial leverage is around 25 and double leverage around 115. So that sounds very safe and solid numbers. An ROE of 12.4 or 10.7 after IAS 19. We believe that the structural resilience of the group and the defendability of the group has further improved with strengthened earnings power, with enhanced and optimized capital base, with an optimized asset portfolio, and a step-by-step but meaningful reduction of non-core risk exposure, for example, in the real estate development business or in the inflation risks in our own pension system. With that, we believe we are ready to be returned to the private sector. When this group set out on a journey about 5 years ago, we said, look, what we want to do is create value for customers, create value to our shareholders, be financially very robust, and be efficient operators. And I think on all those levers, the group is delivering, and I firmly believe will continue to deliver. We've set an earnings level that is good and appears to be sustainable. Over the past years, any revenue decline that we've seen, we've matched it with a commensurate cost decline, and the profit of the group has increased by 50% in the last 5 years, almost structurally. And with that, the group in terms of revenues is transitioning from a 50-50 life, non-life to a 60 non-life, 40 life business from a revenue side. Again, underpinning the structural and lasting elements of our results. So with that, we believe we should be ready to go back to the private sector and comfortable start to 2015. With that, I conclude my presentation. I would like to leave the floor for questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, as mentioned before, questions can only be asked via the conference call and not via the webcast. Before we start the Q&A session, please turn off the sound of your computer for those who have a question. To register for the question and answer queue, please press star 1 on your phone. Go ahead, please, star 1. So the first question is from Jan-Willem Knol from ABN AMRO. Go ahead, sir.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my questions. Just coming back to the UFR impact of 81 percentage points, how comfortable are you with this element of your solvency? And do you view the UFR impact as fully dividendable? And as to your interest rate hedging, I think you mentioned you hedge economically, yeah, so you don't take into account the impact of the UFR. With the interest rates at current very low levels, would you consider sort of reversing that strategy and sort of reducing your interest rate hedging more to and basically taking into account the UFR going forward? And just on Solvency II, you mentioned you stick with the standard model. Can you give a bit more color on why that is? And could you, could this be changed in the near future? Thanks.
Yeah, Willem, thank you. Thank you for these questions. On the UFR, we like to be fully transparent in our results. The UFR affects or supports every single insurance company in the Netherlands. We believe it's only right to be fully transparent and open on its impact. The impact is large because of the drop in interest rates, right? The gap between the UFR and, for example, the 30-year swap rate is about 3 full percentage points these days. Do we feel comfortable? Yes, because the UFR, our Solvency I ex-UFR, still is safely over 200%. So that means the dividend that we propose to our shareholder, the Dutch state, the taxpayer, or actually you in this case, is comfortable with 138.9, and we feel fully comfortable paying out dividends on our results, simply because even after deduction of the UFR, our solvency is very stable and solid. I do believe the UFR is here to stay. How it will develop, it is actually reading tea leaves. I don't know. At this point, I have no indication the UFR will not be here. But for us, it's important to monitor the UFR impact closely and to make sound and well-balanced judgments on our solvency. But for us, solvency ex-UFR above 200 is safe and sound, and we feel very comfortable paying out any current dividends and also any future dividends. Jacques, you want to talk about the impact of the UFR on hedging?
Yeah, you asked the question whether we are thinking about reversing the hedging that now is based on an economic level, on an economic curve, to hedging based on a UFR curve. And indeed, the way we hedged up till now, based on the economic curve, proved to be very successful, meaning that we apply a relative lower curve, and in including U of R, that we are overhedging. And that is also the reason that we also apply as a precondition that we limit the impact on SCR, which is including U of R, of a sudden interest rate increase to a certain percentage. So we are indeed taking into account also the situation of the low interest rate environment and also the impact of U of R.
So to summarize, we are fully hedged against a decline in rates, but in the last recent months, because of the exceptional rate situation that we're in and the long-term view that we have, we've said, look, we don't want to only be protected against falling rates, also against a rapid increase in rates. So there's a cap on our hedging that we don't want to be negatively affected if rates start to increase from here. As again, we don't know when it will occur, how it will occur, but in the long run, an increase in rates will at some point happen, then it could go very fast. So we are looking beyond the current situation and trying to be shielded and protected against the impact of rates increase. So Willem, on your question on the standard model, we feel comfortable with the standard model. We have an ECAP, our own economic capital model. That's the model that we steer on, that we do base our asset allocation on, that we base our pricing decision on. The gap between ECAP and S2 is about 15 percentage points, 1.5 percentage points. We don't intend to apply for an internal model. It is my belief and our fear, depending how you look at it, that it will be a hard sell to get full approval for an internal model by the regulator, especially if you want to use the internal model for capital release and taking capital out of the business. Especially in the current low rate environment, I think the macro prudential policy is aimed at not supporting insurance companies who would like to achieve capital release by modeling changes. So we feel comfortable with the standard model. It's a very cost efficient approach. We just forego the massive costs that are associated with building an internal model, building the application, the documentation, the independent reviews, the consulting hours that go with an internal model and the approval for that. So with that, you know, we are a very relatively simple business and simple folks. Why would we spend all those millions of euros on a model that ultimately is unlikely to get you the real capital relief, and rather make sure we understand the standard model well, but work internally with the ECAP model that we already have?
Very clear. Thanks.
The next question is from Matthias De Wit from BCC Securities. Go ahead, sir.
Good afternoon. Congratulations first with the good set of results. I had a few questions. First is on the remittance ratio. I missed that in the presentation, but maybe you can provide some comments on how much cash you were able to upstream to the holding company in 2014 and how we should think about remittances going forward. Maybe you can express them in terms of operating earnings. Second is on unit link mis-selling. The pressure on the industry is building a bit again to come up with higher compensation. So how what is your feeling here? Do you intend to conclude a new settlement, or is that not at all on the agenda at this point in time? Third question is on the outlook for life earnings. Interest rates are low, the back book is declining, so what do you expect in 15 and 16? Are there any profitable opportunities to reinvest the capital release from declining back book to maintain earnings, and can you also maybe keep spreads at the current level by reinvesting in higher risk assets? And just a final question, and sorry to take so much of your time, but on the UFR again, can you provide some indication to what extent it impacts the unwind cost of your liabilities? So your liabilities unwind at a discount rate, an average rate, which becomes higher merely because you include the UFR for long-tail liabilities. So could you provide some indication of how much the liability discount rate would have been without UFR and how much it is with UFR on average? Thanks.
Piers, thank you. Your first question is on the remittance ratio. What we do, we monitor and map very closely what we call fungible capital. That's capital which one could take out of the life or the OTC, if you wish, and upstream to the holding. At this point in time, because we're actually not a listed company, we're a state-owned company, we don't need to upstream all that capital up to the holding as long as it yields and returns sufficiently into the business. I can tell you the amount of fungible capital is a three-digit figure, and the amount of new fungible or upstreamable capital that we create every year is more than three times the dividend that we intend to pay out over this year. So we feel very comfortable with the amount of capital generation that we have. As I told you, we have about 1.5%-2%, and actually close to 2% IGD capital generation per month. At this point, the money is kept in the operating and in the insurance entities simply because there's no immediate need to upstream to the holding and the company, and the money yields, you know, a good set of results and returns in the business. If we wanted to, we could reverse it. And if, depending on the ownership structure of the group in the future, we might just change that. But suffice to say, at this point, we do monitor and track the creation of free capital, and we do link it to dividend, and it's a multiple of the dividend that we intend to pay out. When it comes to unit-linked, we have made arrangements with the various foundations, the Stichtingen, if you wish. You may recall we provisioned a couple of years ago 1.1 billion for that. The remaining provision is 183 million, which is absolutely sufficient to work out the remaining actions on those deals. We do not intend, and we have no reason to renegotiate with these foundations, simply because we have made an arrangement, we have made promises, and we're living up to these promises. So what we do is work out, just do the work that is linked to those foundation agreements. There are no loose ends and no open ends. We're just working it out, and the provision is absolutely sufficient. When it comes to the niet opbouwende polissen, non-accumulating policies in English, we've achieved our own objectives and the ones we agreed with the AFM, activating 83% of our customers. So what we do today is activate customers and work out the arrangement that we put in place in the past, and there is no intention or no sign that we need to do anything else beyond that. And we're safely provisioned for that. When it comes to what's going to happen in 2015-16 with the life book, the life book will inevitably continue to shrink, just the sheer expiration of policies. As that unnatural lapses are back to 1.5%, so that's actually something that's almost the natural noise you have around expirations. So it's a predictable decline. The decline of the book will take place, but it's a long tail of business. So the real cash generation for all the Dutch insurance companies is not going to happen in 15-16. It's a longer trajectory where these books decline. We talk about 10 to 20 year horizons before these books really run off. When it comes to whatever capital is freed up, will we reinvest? That depends, of course, on opportunities. If we reinvest, we could do it especially in the, I think, in the P&C side. We might reinvest in some small specific acquisitions that add mortality or longevity risk in a balanced manner to the group. But really, acquisitions that strengthen the group. For example, last year we bought Van Kampen Groep, which is a service provider that really supports us and will support us in the P&C side.
And do you see an opportunity to redeploy capital within the life business, for example, underwriting group pensions, or is pricing not meeting your standards at this point in time?
Need to see. I think pricing is slowly returning to more healthy levels, but we need to see it. We've seen in the past year wide fluctuations in pricing. We've seen the past year all the markets having to deal with rapidly falling interest rates. And we saw in the last quarter a restoration of normal pricing in the pension side, which I think also is a function of solvency and capital levels of some of our peers, where they'd be willing to write new business at fantasy guarantees or not. At this point in time, we could deploy the capital in the pension business, but we tend to be very disciplined in doing that. So we will not go blindly into buying blocks of business if you don't meet the return hurdle. So, Matthias, we could. We're active in the market. We've increased our pension activities in the last year. We've increased our standing with, I think, the pension intermediaries because we felt that the market is probably closer to a normalized pricing level than it was in the past. But you know, seeing is believing. We need to see how things develop. It could be an option. Alternatively, there could be ways to acquire smaller companies, monoline insurance companies that could come up to our business. But again, all of us will be very diligent.
Okay.
When it comes to the unwind and the impact of the UFR on the unwind of liabilities, I don't have that number at hand. What I find actually more important is what's the result, the return we make on our investment book, and what's the average guarantee? The return we make on our investment book is about 3.4%. It's a direct yield. We have a shadow accounting methodology in which some capital gains are amortized over time. That adds another 30 to 40 basis points to that yield. So including shadow accounting, we're at 3.7-3.8% direct investment return on our book. And the weighted average guarantee is around 2.8. If you look at the breakdown of our guaranteed book and the different guarantees, it's about 2.8. So irrespective of whatever discounting curve we use, I tend to look at what does the investment book yield, what's the guarantee that we have, and is there still a margin between the two? And at this point in time, there still is.
But that's for IFRS, I guess. But when you look at capital generation, I guess the most relevant spread to look at is those between the running yield on asset side and swap plus UFR on the liability side. So how is that spread, including and excluding UFR, or do you not have that number available?
I don't have it at hand, but for the bulk of our business, look, 40% of our book, or close to 50% of our book is now a P&C book, right? So the UFR only kicks in after 20 years. So up to 20 years, the discounting curve is swap plus a 21 basis point volatility adjuster. Compared to the running yields of 3.4 or 3.7, we feel still very safe. But there is a positive margin. I don't have the number at hand, but it's actually a significant margin that's still in between the two.
Okay. Thanks.
The next question is from Albert Ploeg from ING. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, good afternoon all. Thank you for taking my questions. One question, also sorry to come back on the Solvency II. Basically, you gave the number of 175%. Maybe can you give some color on what, let's say, the comfort range is on the number with, let's say, the uncertainties that are still out there on matching premium, the volatility adjuster and tax treatments? So basically, did you take, let's say, a very conservative approach on this, or did you take what basically is currently available? So maybe somewhat color there. Question basically on the balance sheet. If I look at the financial leverage ratio, I think around 30% with a very good coverage, by the way. But it is a little bit high, so it seems, and also the double leverage. So, yeah, how do you look at those two ratios also in relation to Solvency II, basically? Also, I had a question a bit on an earlier question also on the remittance on the holding. I do understand you basically managing the business currently from a really a holding perspective. But can you maybe give some feeling at least what the financial costs and the holding expenses are on an annualized basis? That would be helpful as well. And my final question, and might have been covered in the presentation, apologies if done so, it's on the mortgage book, the valuation thereof. You've probably seen some competitors already commenting on the third quarter and one also today on this. So I was wondering how that sector discussion impacted your valuation and if there was any impact on ICD profit or loss or Shell's equity. Thank you.
Very good, thank you. Your first question on the stability of the solvency number. Of course, it is an estimate in a world where there's still some uncertainty around what I believe the modeling and the parameters. We did not assume any matching adjustment or any relief from matching adjustment solutions in that solvency number. We work with a 21 basis points volatility adjuster as per DNB's published curve. That is something that will be further refined and comforted by EIOPA going forward. And of course, there's the tax recoverability assumption. That is a specific phenomenon where we believe there will be further scrutiny by EIOPA and DNB on that factor. And although our models tell us, really, if we do the modeling, that we should be able to assume 100% tax recoverability. We don't have deferred tax assets. We don't have deferred tax liabilities on our balance sheet. So we should assume full the tax recoverability. For prudency purposes, we marked it down to 75% because there is a debate or there is some hint that EIOPA might look at this in a more stringent way, moving away a bit from the regular tax assumptions. That is really a judgment call that we made. So with that, we believe the 175 is a reasonably prudent number, but for all intents and purposes, I would have an 8 to 10% bandwidth on the upside and the downside around that number. Although what I see in the first month of this year, this is the first result, I think the solvency generation per month is still very positive in the same way as last year. So I think also on S2, we should be able to generate 1 to 2% solvency each year, simply because the underwriting result in our non-life business continues to be strong. And that's actually a very safe and stable contributor to our solvency level. On the leverage side, you asked a question about our financial leverage and interest cover. Well, but to me, the interest cover is the most important metric because that really is the cash metric that is least affected by potential accounting effects. We've calculated this using the S&P methodology. Yep. On financial leverage, I feel comfortable with leverage around 30%. That's kind of a ballpark range, plus or minus a small range. The current 31 is pushed up by the IAS 19, which is basically the 500 million impact of the valuation of our own pension exposure. If you took it out, it would be 25%. So given the fact that I look for a 30% debt leverage, it's 31 including IAS 19 and 25 if you exclude it. I feel comfortable with that number, especially as also the interest cover is around almost 9.5 times. So that gives us a very solid debt profile. In terms of remittance, yes, there are holding costs. Basically, what we said is the remittance ratio or the ability to cover holding costs out of free capital generation is about well over 3 times the annual dividend. We think there could be room to improve that further. How big are the holding costs? I would say there's a regular holding cost and is one-off holding cost. Regular holding costs tend to be around 40 to 50 million per year. And then there could be one-off costs, for example, concluding the Solvency II project. There could be one-off costs from strategic projects are related to the exit. They could, you know, amount to significant numbers, but they really are incidentals. Structurally, our holding runs about 40 million-50 million euros cost a year.
Okay.
Which is majorly passed through actually also to the business lines.
That's purely the holding cost, also including financing costs for any debt on the holding, or is that not included in that for?
That really is operating costs in the holding.
Operating costs, okay. Maybe one small up on the Solvency II. If I look at your slide 12, okay, that's of course sensitivity on Solvency I basis, where of course credit spreads and also equities are quite the biggest drivers there.
Yeah.
Is there still in your number of 175% any management actions that you're potentially considering that could have a positive effect, like maybe hedging some equity positions, et cetera? On the credit spread, how sensitive is, let's say, the Solvency II number on tightening or widening of credit spreads, if you can give some feeling?
Yeah. Well, the 175 does not include or need any immediate management actions in the sense that the 175 number is something we feel comfortable with.
Yeah.
Is that we have a balanced mortality longevity book. There's no need to hedge either excess longevity or hedge excess mortality. We have reduced our reinsurance exposure in the year. I think our reinsurance spend is almost halved because of the solvency situation of the group, and the fact that at some point we feel very much in control of our book. We feel comfortable with the investment portfolio, where there is a put under the illiquid part of our investment of our Dutch equities. The strike of the put is around 75% of current market conditions. The solvency number does not include or presuppose any management actions. If we needed to, yes, we could reinsure the P&C business. We could reinsure longevity risk. We could reduce equity exposure. The fact our real estate business is currently now in funds, either it's retail or it's housing, it's in funds. We can also invite third-party investors in those funds to lay off, to reduce our real estate exposure. At this point, I don't see any reason to incur additional hedging costs or drop investment income, because at 175, it would be uneconomical to do so.
That's very clear.
Yeah. With respect to, let's say, spread risk, it is important to understand that we apply strategic asset allocation studies where we optimize the portfolio mix based on the Solvency II outcomes. The probabilities that limits for Solvency II, so ECap and SCR, would not be reached. Of course, spread risk is a main risk in the portfolio, but it is also an important driver for the running yield in the portfolio, as Chris explained.
Yeah. Really, just to be clear, on the underlying capital generation, the 1.5%-2% number really is a monthly generation of solvency, not an annual generation, just to make sure that we are all on the same page here. There was a question on the mortgage book, I believe, as well. Jack?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. The valuation, let's say, as I explained, we use the very conservative approach of the top-down method, where you don't take into account the futures interest margins by our own bank-generated and originated mortgages. The impact of the top-down method was, in Solvency I terms, about 15 percentage points, 15, and in Solvency II terms, it was 9 percentage points. As you can understand, the futures margins will be recovered during the lifetime of the mortgages.
Okay. Thank you. That's very helpful.
The next question is from David Andrich from Morgan Stanley. Go ahead, sir.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my questions. First of all, I was just wondering, around your disclosure with both the UFR, I found that quite interesting. I guess my question is the DNB essentially kind of looking through the UFR, and is that different under Solvency I versus Solvency II? Can you give any indication of how different the impact of the UFR is under those two regimes? I just wanted to follow up on one of your comments about the regulatory environment not supporting capital release off model changes. And I was just I was wondering then, does that mean essentially that the standard model is essentially kind of the binding constraint there? And if so, you know, what is kind of the minimum level the DNB is looking for?
I would love to forward your questions to DNB. maybe that would be more appropriate, but I can give you a mind read on my interpretation of the situation. On the UFR, we felt it was appropriate to disclose the impact of the UFR because the impact is at its peak since the introduction, and it would be only fair for the market to understand, to appreciate what the impact is. And again, we're comfortable with solvency ex UFR to be at 200. It is my understanding that our regulator does not apply a very mechanical single perspective on the world. They look at Solvency I, Solvency II, including UFR, excluding UFR, and the source of capital generation. That means if I had to deliver, if I delivered, or we delivered, a great solvency, but the real increase was all due to model changes, DNB would be pressing us very hard to pay out a dividend. If, however, we delivered good solvency, good profit generation from underwriting results, but had to deal with significant UFR impact, DNB would accept that if you make money, you can pay it out to shareholders. So it's not a simple world, but you could almost make a mental matrix saying, two by two, is the result driven by modeling changes or underlying profit? And is there a, what is the solvency in excluding UFR? The worst situation is if you have capital increase by modeling result and the UFR is huge. In that model, you would be in the bottom left corner of that mental matrix. And DNB would, you know, you need to have a pretty convincing story to pay out lots of dividend. The best situation is if you create value from running an insurance company, underwriting results, or making real money, and you have a solvency which is sufficient after UFR, there would be no problem at all. The other two boxes, it depends. So mentally, you could plot insurance companies in that kind of two-by-two framework. And you can see I'm a McKinsey consultant, right? That's how I tend to think. And life's good if you're in the top right box in any matrix. So generally speaking, that's the way DNB tends to look at the world. But they will ask you, what's the impact on the UFR? Where does your money come from? And are you eating into reserves by modeling changes or not? From our perspective, if I apply this matrix to ASR, we're, of course, in the top right quarter in this carefully designed framework. But I think from our side, we feel comfortable with, yes, a significant UFR impact, but it's above 200 and a result from operating results. On your question, is the standard model becoming the binding constraint? That could very well be the case. I don't know. I mean, we have not applied for an internal model. We have not engaged DNB for a debate on the internal model, so I don't speak from experience. But I would be surprised if DNB would not weigh or take into account the standard model. I don't think DNB will look only at the internal model. DNB would ask you, if you were to come up with significant dividend, what does solvency look under various frameworks and how to balance those? And I think if there would be a massive gap between the internal model and the standard model, the bigger the gap, the harder your battle becomes with the regulator to get full approval.
Okay.
When it comes to the impact of UFR on Solvency II, David, I find it hard to disclose because the Solvency II model as such is already, you know, surrounded with a certain degree of uncertainty. If it would start to attribute that model to underlying parameters, the uncertainty would exponentially increase. So bear with me, the 81 impact on S1, I'm very comfortable with. On S2, bear with us how it evolves and how the model evolves.
Thank you. That's very, very helpful.
The last question from now is from Mr. San Giorgio from First Capital. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. I've got two remaining questions. One on the VOBA impairment. If you could give us a bit more flavor, because if I understand it right, it's around one third of the on the VOBA that you have. So it's pretty significant. And the second one was on the mortgage valuations. how comfortable you are that in the future there shouldn't be major shakeups, and how does your methodology for valuing mortgages differ from typical market practices? Thanks.
I will take the question on VOBA. Jacques will go on the mortgage side. The total VOBA at the beginning of the analysis was 225 million. You're indeed correct. We wrote off, we impaired one third. Historically, we always did our VOBA test by looking at the life portfolio as a whole, a holistic approach, comparing the different LATs, IFRS and DNB LAT, to the VOBA. This year, we decided to do it on a granular level, nominal first unit linked, and portfolio line by line. And there we found that for a certain group of unit linked portfolios, the LAT test was positive, but not sufficient to sustain the VOBA. And therefore, we decided to impair that VOBA. Which means, I can tell you, if a discussion with our auditors, we kicked the tires of our VOBA book left, right, and center, meaning that anything that was vulnerable is written off. The VOBA that was not impaired today is actually pretty safe and stable. And for us, it was a reasonably nice coincidence that the VOBA impairment happened coincidentally whilst we had a IAS 19 accounting benefit of roughly the same size. But we did a fair chunk of analysis to look at the sustainability and defendability of the remaining of the VOBA. And again, the LAT reserves of our life book by DNB or IFRS are still really significant three-digit numbers, three-digit surpluses. So with that, we felt it was appropriate to impair the VOBA on the unit link business. And if you take a non-accounting view, just put aside the IFRS handbook and say what's going on in this market, then it is clear that the profitability of the unit link business is not going to come back. So that's why we also felt, irrespective of what IAS 8 or IAS 39 tells you, the profitability of the unit link book is not going to return, and there's no point in maintaining the VOBA. So also from a qualitative perspective, I felt really comfortable taking this decision and impairing what needs to be impaired on our portfolio. On the mortgage side, Jacques?
Yeah, concerning your question with respect to what will become market practice, it's difficult to say. You have two schools there, the school top-down evaluating, and the other school also based on the market input, the bottom-up based on mortgage-backed securities, so all the tranches that are issued in the market. I can only say that we feel that there is a debate. There's a debate also with the supervisor. And what we did is that we took the most conservative approach, so the top-down approach. And that's what I can say on that.
Okay, so but it's because I'm seeing a lot of fair value adjustments on mortgages, and
yeah.
And it's something that comes from the regulator, huh? As well.
Yeah, it's a debate that maybe was instigated by the regulator, and that's debate in the sector on the valuation of mortgages.
Yeah, Mr. San Giorgio, we took the debate very to our heart, and the regulator instigated a review evaluation of mortgages, expressed a clear preference for value mortgage using the consumer markets as a starting point, so tariffs based on actual live mortgages that are offered to consumers, which is the most conservative approach. We decided to pursue that approach. For us, it's important to see how the rest of the market acts and whether there's a sufficient level playing field. But we said, let's take the conservative, prudent approach to start with. And from here, it can only get better. And if I find that the rest of the market takes another approach, we might adjust it. But at this point, we felt it was appropriate to take the most conservative approach and lower and reduce the value of the mortgages using the most conservative method. That shaved off about 15% as one and 9% as two. But first, it feels that that's now behind us. And from here, we've valued mortgages as the most prudent conservative method that we could think of as per DNB guidelines.
Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, if there are any additional questions or remarks, please press star one. The next question is from Mr. De Wit from KBC Securities. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, I had one more follow-up question, please. On the 175% minimum target for the ECAP ratio, can you talk me through how you set that number and where regulators are looking at under Solvency II? Is there any indication you could provide of or rating agencies where the bar will be set under Solvency II going forward, or where you feel would be appropriate? Thank you.
Matthias, you just asked a million-dollar question in the final minute of this call. Look, there are various ways you could approach or tackle this issue. I'll first talk about the outcome, where we are today, and secondly, how we got there. On ECAP, we tend to look at anything above 75. Once above 75, I feel comfortable and sleep well at night. When it comes to Solvency II, there's actually a letter, a formal letter of intervention or a letter of comfort, right? Our risk appetite stipulates the lowest level S2 is 120%. Below 120, we are almost forced or committed to do take remedial actions to support solvency.
Is that the regulatory threshold, or is it like your internal?
It's our own internal risk appetite.
Okay.
It's our internal risk appetite that is approved by all supervisory board or committees. 120 is below that. You need to do remedial actions. I think DNB will start to get actually calling you between 100 and 120, but given that we've put it at 120 as the risk appetite limit, that's also something that they will take very seriously. The next level of comfort is 140. 140 is a level at which we would like to start pricing products, and once it gets to below 140, I need to think very hard about future dividend payments. There's no reason not, there's no formal rule, but effectively 140 is a level when, the remedial action threshold of 120 comes close. And then again, it's a function of why you get to 140 and the speed at which you get to 140, but 140 is not our, say, traffic light. In terms of where do I feel comfortable, it's a 160 to 200% range, which I appreciate is a fairly wide range, and I think that will narrow over time as we get more clarity on the models. But 160 to 180 is a range that I, as a CFO, feel I sleep well at night. I feel very comfortable we can just pay out dividends without any debate, without any issue. We can keep the investment portfolio as it is. On the ECAP side, it is at this point 175 to 200. On ECAP, we've driven that number basically from the ORSA, the Own Risk Self-Assessment and Solvency Assessment. When you start scenario testing and stress testing the group, we found that with a 175 to 200 range, the group is able to sustain. We end up with very adverse negative scenarios according to our own ORSA analysis. So basically we said if we take the lower end, you add the ORSA stress, you get to a 175 to 200% range of ECAP. That, combined with the fact that Solvency II tends to run at 15 to 20% below ECAP, typically, right? The 175 to 200% of ECAP corresponds to a 160 to 200% of solvency. Could be a bit lower, but I'm taking a wider range because of the uncertainty. So to make a long story short, we've looked at this very much from an ORSA perspective. Could we absorb significant negative shocks? And if those shocks occur, could we still be alive? That drives the ECAP number with which we steer the business. And in line with that, we have a solvency target where the latter is 120 is our risk appetite. 140 is not a traffic light. And I would go back to my shareholder and say, look, we may need to think long and hard about paying the full amount of dividends if we drop below 140. And actually, I'm striving for 160 to 180. That's where I feel very comfortable. If I look at the European insurance sector, that is where I think the sector is gravitating to. Numbers still vary widely, but then there are some who use an ECAP model, some use a standard model. We feel 160 to 200 for the standard model is where we want to be. And it's in line with 175 to 200 for the ECAP model.
That's very helpful. Thanks a lot for your open and transparent, helpful answers. Have a good day. Thanks.
Gentlemen, there are no further questions. Please continue.
All right. Gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Time for some closing remarks. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you very much for your very safe and solid and very robust questions. Again, safety, we feel comfortable with these numbers. I feel comfortable coming home tonight with this presentation. I'll still be allowed to come in. And I hope to see you all soon in person. And is there any further questions, you know where to find us. Don't hesitate to ask. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes this ASR event call. You may now disconnect your line. Thank you.